This is our eighth Pub Theology now. We've been running it once a month since July last year. And we've got the special pleasure of having Sam Clear tonight, who's come from Tasmania and he's in Adelaide for 2 weeks speaking at schools. And this is his first speaking engagement of the speaking tour while he's down in Adelaide. Now, I've got a bit of a bio here on Sam, so I'll just read it out so you'll know a bit about Sam if you don't already. Now, Sam Clear is of Youth Mission Team Australia, and he decided to take a year out to walk 29,000 kilometres around the globe praying for the unity of all Christians. Setting out in December 2006, Sam Clear walked from the easternmost point of Brazil up through South America, Central America and North America, across Russia and down through Europe to Santiago de Compostela, Spain. The journey encompassed approximately 29,000 kilometres over 564 days, of which approximately 18,000 was covered on foot. During his pilgrimage, he had the experience of being mugged at knife point, had to find food and water every day, relied on the hospitality of complete strangers. He was threatened at gunpoint, came face to face with dangerous animals. He was left bashed on the side of the road and experienced temperatures from minus 33 up to 47 degrees. So you can see his talk's going to be quite interesting tonight. He's got a few experiences he's going to share with us. So without further ado, I'd just like to put your hands together for Sam Clear. Thanks.
Up a little bit. Good evening. It is great to be here. I actually lived in Adelaide 2003-2004, so it's great to be back here. I got a message from a friend saying welcome home as soon as I touched down. My story we'll get into in just a moment, because we've come here for a certain reason. We might begin with a quick prayer. So if you'd like to just bow your head and we'll pray. Holy Father, we hand this night over to you. We ask you, Lord, that you would work through all our struggles, all our hopes, all our dreams, and we pray, Lord, that you would use us for your greater glory and you would help us to discover who we are in you and to discover our true potential. And we pray this in your name. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, what I want to do to begin with is just go back beyond before the walk itself. I went to, I grew up in Tasmania, central Tassie, and I studied mechanical engineering at the University of Tasmania, and it was every kind of ist you can think of. It was racist, sexist, chauvinist. Our engineering faculty actually holds the Southern Hemisphere record for the most beer consumed by university faculty, being 33 barrels of beer in one afternoon. The lifestyle that went with this engineering faculty was horrendous. To the point where it actually challenged me to take my faith more seriously. I was a Sunday-going Catholic, and in the engineering faculty, for the fact that I went to Mass on a Sunday, made me God Boy, along with another guy. He was actually God Boy 1 and I was God Boy 2, because I wasn't quite as good as him. But I was genuinely challenged through the lifestyle of the engineering faculty, and at the end of my degree decided I needed to put my faith into action. And I was in love with the idea of going to Africa and digging holes and filling them with water, but ended up in Sydney working with youth, and actually worked with Youth Mission Team Australia, and that's actually how I ended up down here in Adelaide for 2 years, working with the team. Actually lived over in Klemzig near Vale Park. And during this time, I spent 5 years working with Youth Mission Team Australia, running seminars, reflection days in high schools around the country. And during that time, they became very aware of the disunity of the church. So I was working as a Catholic missionary, but had a lot of non-Catholic Christian friends. And repeatedly, I was being asked by them to join their church because I obviously believed in God and therefore I should become a Christian. But being Catholic, I obviously wasn't Christian and obviously didn't believe in Jesus. So I should join their church because I appeared to have some sort of faith. And what really started to bug me, though, was that some of these churches weren't actually working on projects together. They didn't want to be involved with one another. So this church is working on, and this wasn't just to do with the Catholics. This was various Protestant churches or evangelical or Pentecostal churches. Seeing that one church was in this area, they just didn't want to be associated with that church. And I picked up a book one day called Surprised by Truth, compiled by a guy called Patrick Madrid, who's a Catholic apologist. And I was just reading it for my own, spiritual nourishment, I guess. I wanted to find out why someone would become a Catholic, because my non-Catholic Christian friends were repeatedly telling me that as a Catholic, I was therefore not Christian. And no matter how I answered their questions, they simply went on to a new question. If I satisfied one question, they'd move on to the next. And so I picked up this book wanting to find out why someone would become a Catholic from another background. And I flicked through and found the story of an evangelical preacher and a Pentecostal minister. And I thought, right, I want to find out why they became Catholic. Read their stories, and they're interesting stories, but what struck me, two of them in a row, was that both of them lost their friends and family completely. When they became Catholic, they had very different journeys. They both became Catholic, and their friends and family never spoke to them again. Their own parents never picked up the phone again. They're both American. They've got caller ID on their phones, on their home phones. And if they rang their mum and dad, they just would not pick up, refused to ever speak to them again. And for me at that time, it was like standing at a car crash and not knowing first aid. I knew that there was something disgustingly wrong happening here. I didn't know what it was. My background was engineering. My background is not theology or philosophy. But there was just something burning within me that this was not the church working as a wholesome, loving church. And it set something off inside me. And I started to pray about it and started to think about what I could do. Eventually, though, came to the conclusion that there was nothing I could do. And so before Mass one day, prayed a very simple prayer, which was, "Dear God, I'd love to help you, but sorry, mate, you're on your own. The problem's too big. The history's too broad. There's too much hurt. There is nothing that I can do to help the unity of the church." Once I'd shut up, in the silence that followed afterwards, just felt like God said very firmly in my heart, "Sam, you can't fix it, but I can. I need you to pray." And so that was just that sense of, I need to pray. And so I began to pray, and I began to invite some of my friends that I was working with in the mission field to pray for unity. The problem was, my Catholic friends all said, "Yes, we'll pray for unity." My non-Catholic Christian friends said, "No, no, no, unity already exists. It's just that you're not a part of it because you're Catholic." And they wouldn't even pray for unity. And it bugged me so much that there was one day I was looking at a world map and I thought, how cool would it be just to sell up? Okay, one of my faith heroes is St. Francis of Assisi. I thought, how awesome would it be to sell up like St. Francis and just walk? And to walk around the world on foot and pray for unity. Do a protest walk. Just walk and pray and stop in every church I pass, whether it was Catholic, Orthodox, Pentecostal, Evangelical, Protestant, non-denominational, interdenominational. Stop at those churches and invite them to pray for unity. Over the course of the following year, that very simple thought solidified and became reality. So I ended up selling everything I owned. Australians are very good at giving money. We're actually the second best country in the world behind the Irish at giving money to causes. We're not very good at praying, though. We're not an overly spiritual country. And so I made a deliberate point of not asking for sponsorship. I funded it myself. I sold my Land Rover and my motorbike, put all my life savings into it, and then invited people to pray. And a lot of people actually came to me with money in hand and said, "We want to give you money to do this." And I said, no, I don't want money. Can you pray for unity?" And they could see it kind of, they get all contorted, because it was a lot easier for them to give the money than it was to actually pray. What happened was, I set off in December of 2006. I flew to Brazil in South America and set off across South America. So from the easternmost point of Brazil on the Atlantic Ocean, headed inland through the Amazon. I took a boat up the Amazon River and then headed north across Venezuela, Colombia, all the way through Central America, up across North America, United States, Canada, to Calgary, and then further north to Edmonton. I flew across the Bering Strait to Vladivostok in far eastern Russia, and then took the train through Siberia. It was minus 40 degrees Celsius on average in the daytime during winter when I was there. I'd actually formulated the plan with Bishop Christopher Prowse in Melbourne, and when we were talking about Siberia, he actually shook his finger at me and said, "You are not walking through Siberia in winter. You are not interested in converting polar bears. Take the train." So we decided I'd take the train through Siberia and then walk again from Moscow, from the Red Square in St. Basil's Cathedral, and then walked across the rest of Russia, through Europe, down to Italy, to the Vatican, around the Mediterranean and into Santiago de Compostela and onto Cape Finisterre, which is what used to be known as the westernmost point of Europe. So literally from one side of the Atlantic Ocean to the other. This wasn't an attempt into the Guinness Book of Records. It was a mission, and it was about prayer. It's just that I chose to take that mission out on foot. So there were times, for example, as I was saying, when I took a boat up the Amazon River, I wasn't too concerned about walking every single step. I think Michael said at the start I walked about 18,000 kilometres on foot. It was actually about 15,500, so it's a little bit less. It was 15,500 kilometres. I know, soft. It's 15,500 kilometres on foot in total. The journey itself was, as you heard from Michael at the start, was not easy whatsoever. The mission was easy. Walk, pray, and invite people to pray. But the execution of that mission was exceedingly difficult. I was held at gunpoint twice, robbed at knife point by four men. Three times woke up in the middle of the night in three different countries with a guy having broken into my room, not to rob me, but on three occasions, a gay guy in my room trying to get into bed with me and have his way with me. So I actually had to fight off three times, three different guys. I was arrested three times, twice in the United States, because they actually couldn't figure out if I was a missionary or a terrorist. And so I was taken in by Homeland Security on two occasions. I was also arrested by the KGB in Belarus. I was wearing a red and white striped T-shirt. Unbeknownst to me, are the colours of revolution against the dictatorship in that country. So I learnt as I went. I had to learn eight languages while I was walking, which was a very taxing mentally, trying to get my head around all these different languages as I walked, trying to find food and water. I averaged about 40 kilometres a day while I was walking. I lost 15 kilograms. I ended up in hospital a number of times. I had food poisoning four times, salmonella poisoning once, typhoid fever once. Had an operation on my big toe twice. Sorry for those who are eating. You can put your forks down at the moment. But at one point, I had a laceration on the side of my toe, and underneath the big toe, the flesh was pushing out halfway across the big toe. The second operation I had, the infection was so bad that they couldn't use anaesthetic. It wasn't making a difference. So they actually operated on me without anaesthetic and just told me to grip my teeth. And they cut the nail in half, pulled half out with pliers, and then cut away part of the big toe with the scalpel. So it was really, really difficult just to get to the end. The hottest day that I had while walking was in Brazil. It was 47 degrees Celsius. At 8 a.m. in the morning, it was already 32, and it just got hotter and hotter as the day went on. And I had a 42-kilometre walk that day, so 47 degrees for 42 k's. My boots were actually sticking to the bitumen on the road. You actually hear them peeling off the bitumen. And at one, I used a Camelback water system, just a water bladder in the backpack with a tube hanging over the shoulder. And at one point, a drop of water went down onto the ground. And when it hit the bitumen, yeah, it just went and was gone, just evaporated. So and I tried to put my hand on the road at one point and just couldn't do it. So it was a lot. You've seen the Australian, like the tennis, when it's 30 degrees and they say, but the court temperature is 80 degrees Celsius. The road temperature was over 100. So it wasn't great. Once I'd finished through South America and I walked across the Grand Savannah in southeastern Venezuela, which is the home of Angel Falls. And the native Indians still live out in the plains. So it's just extraordinary. It's like Dances with Wolves, walking across the plains and meeting the local Indians and restocking my food supplies and learning the language from them. Winter hit me when I got to North America. I had 8 months going through the tropics, and I had carried a hammock with me and just slept out wherever I could. A lot of churches gave me accommodation. Occasionally I get a hotel I needed a bed and a shower. And then once I got up into North America, sent my hammock home and bought myself a tent. And winter hit me really hard. I was arriving just at the beginning of winter and heading further north into it. The coldest day, as Michael said earlier, was minus 33 degrees Celsius. And I had a 38-kilometre walk that day. It's really difficult to explain what it's like walking in those temperatures. But if you went outside as you're dressed right now, you've got about 5 minutes before your skin begins to blister like a third-degree burn. But that doesn't matter because you've only got 30 seconds before your lungs begin to freeze. They actually begin to stick to each other and they freeze. You've seen Dumb and Dumber? Right, you know when he sticks his tongue onto the pole and it sticks, freezes? Your lungs do that to each other and they freeze together. And after 5 to 10 minutes, you'll just fall over through lack of oxygen and die. Now, I needed a volunteer for a second to come and help me out just for a moment. Anyone? Come on, thank you. What's your name? Brad, what I'm going to get you to do, can I get you to throw my balaclava on, please? It's been washed. But this is what I had to wear while I was... No. So if you can put the goggles on over the top, but you've got to keep that nose piece on at the same time. Keep that over your nose. So what Brad's got on, this is just the first layer. So absolutely every single piece of skin had... You can understand why I got arrested now, can't you? You had to... No, I actually wasn't wearing this both times. But I had... So every single bit of skin had to be covered up completely. And what Brad has in front of his nose there's a layering system on the balaclava. And so as he breathes out, there's the moisture on his breath warms up those pieces of material. And so then when he breathes back in at minus 33, it warms the air up and he breathes it in at, say, minus 10, which is still really cold, but it's not going to kill you. So that's going to warm up pretty soon. I'll get you to put these on. That's the left glove. I might actually take this out if I can. No, I can't. Okay, I'm taking this with me. So what we start off with something like this. It's just a body armor glove. So that'll only keep you warm down to about zero. So then you go with something like this, which is a leather insulated glove, just push down hard. Okay, this glove will get you down to, say, minus 10, maybe minus 15. If you're lucky, I guess you put that one on as well. I don't have the other little small glove. I lost it in Russia, and I'm not going back to get it. So those gloves will do you till about minus 10, minus 15. To get down to minus 20, you've then got to go again. Now, these are insulated ski mitts, and these will help you, as I said, about minus 20. And then to get down to minus 30... or minus 33, you've got to have in the palm of your hands little chemical reaction pads. Had them in my boots as well. And even at that, with all that, and the chemical reaction pads heat up to 50 degrees Celsius and will last for about 7 hours. But even then, I was losing the feeling in my fingertips. Here's the problem, though. I'm walking about 40 kilometres a day. In fact, USA and Canada, I averaged 50 kilometres a day walking. And I was eating a lot. I was actually eating 4 meals a day. I was eating about 20 muesli bars a day. A lot of fruit, etc. I can't, if there's nothing between the towns, I have to stop in the snow, in the cold to eat, and I can't take any of this gear off. Brad, can you open the muesli bar for me? I'm going to have a drink. Okay, Brad is dying. Thank you. You didn't even... Okay, it's... Actually, I'll hold on to this. It was very difficult just to open them. And then once it was open, the problem then is eating. Okay, there isn't a nice hole here for you to stick the muesli bar up into. So I'll just move this closer. So what you had to do was just pull this down so you can eat. But again, the dumb and dumber theory with the everything sticking because it's frozen. There's moisture on this. It only takes 10 seconds and it sticks solid. It becomes an ice block. And so when you lift it back up, you expose your neck. So what I had to do was eat, lift up, take another bite, lift up. And so you're walking down the road doing the kind of the circus trick, just trying to eat and stay alive. Can we give Brad a round of applause for his help? Thank you. Well done. Just pull. And again. Nice. Thank you. One day the muesli bar was frozen so solid I had to lever it between my teeth and it snapped on an upward motion and I was putting a lot of force on it. I literally punched myself in the head and actually had to sit down on the side of the road. I hurt myself. Once I'd finished with North America, headed across into Russia, was amazed to see a guy swimming in Vladivostok Bay. They cut a swimming pool into the ice. And I was walking across the ice and there's a guy swimming beside me. And I took the train through Siberia, which is an experience in itself, 7 days on a train. The train came plummeting to a halt at one point because a drunk guy in the middle of wilderness had stopped the train. So the engineer got off the train with a hammer in hand and thankfully didn't use the hammer, but he used a huge karate kick and knocked this guy flat in the snow and got back on the train and we drove off. So it was an eye-opener. Going through there. And then from Moscow, headed off on foot again. It was very difficult coming through Russia. I found it difficult to speak Russian, and I was finding it more difficult to find someone who spoke English to teach me Russian as I was walking. At one point, though, got beaten up on the side of the road. That was in Russia. Just walked past an intersection out in the middle of the wilderness, and it was snow, it was still winter, and two guys dressed in black came running down the hillside towards me. They crossed over the road, one stood in front, one stood beside me. They started speaking very aggressively in Russian, and all I could say at that point was, "Can I have fish, please? Thank you. And where's the church?" And they weren't asking for either of those, so I had no idea what they were saying. And then they just nodded to one another and just went whack and just started both lay in as hard as they could and started to beat me up. All I could do, they were both in my face trying to punch me, and so there was just this opportunity to grab them both around the neck at one point, and so I grabbed them both and pushed them apart, and it didn't hold them off the ground, not quite that strong, but pushed them back. I'm 6'5", and they were kind of average height. They're pretty solid guys, though. But once I held them apart, they were still trying to punch me, but their arms weren't quite reaching. So they're kind of swinging underneath my arms. But neither of them had cut their fingernails, and so they started to claw at my hands, and they started to rip the skin off. One guy put his thumbnail through the webbing between my finger and thumb. So it was kind of a bit painful at the time and needed to get out of there quickly, and managed to get them both on the ground. One guy actually got off balance, so I was able to kind of throw them both on the ground and just run as fast as I could. One of them gave chase. They broke my walking poles. I was using carbon fibre walking poles, like ski poles, but for walking. They were broken in half. The top strap of my backpack was snapped off in the fight. Ran off down the road with one of the guys giving chase with the broken walking poles. I could hear the whoosh whoosh behind me. But thankfully, the other guy was actually hurt when he hit the ground, and so he didn't get up, and the guy chasing me stopped to go back and help him. So I pulled my camera out and started to film them, still trying to get my breath and started trying to say what was happening. And while this is happening, a third guy came running down the hill with a bottle of vodka in hand, sprinting down through the snow, whistling out to the other two guys because he wants in the fight. But thankfully, the other two guys didn't come back, and he didn't want to cross the road by himself, so it left me to run off down the road into the wilderness again, on a bit of an adrenaline high. It was a bit scary too, because at that time I was praying the rosary and focusing on the sorrowful mysteries and Jesus' docileness before his aggressors. And here I was, having just beaten up two guys and running off down the road thinking that was not what Jesus did. The scary thing was, 2 weeks later in Belarus, the same thing happened again. I still struggle to walk past 15 to 25-year-old males standing on the side of the road in a group. I still get a bit clammy and watching their hands as I walk down the road. Once I'd finished with Eastern Europe, headed down into Austria, Italy, to the Vatican, was invited, had spent the day in the Vatican with the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, which was not holy and pious and people walking around with their hands clasped. It was like Year 12 muck-up day. They were literally bouncing off the walls. It was the complete opposite to what I thought the Vatican would be. It was loud, it was raucous, and they loved their work. And then headed around the Mediterranean into Spain and finished on Cape Finisterre. Walking 15,500 kilometres on foot over a year and a half meant that I did come face-to-face with some pretty dangerous animals while I was walking. Some of them were cute and cuddly, some of them weren't. I met a pig in Mexico. There was a huge thunderstorm, and I sheltered under a fallen-down bus stop. And while I was sheltering from the rain, a pig came around the corner and sheltered with me in the bus stop. And just because, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere and being stupid, I started to talk to it in a Swedish accent and started to massage it and tell it I was going to make it into bacon. And it laid down on the ground and fell asleep while I'm massaging it. And it actually, I swear, it had a smile on its face. And it had this little grin. And it started to snore. And so once the storm had finished, I headed off down the road and through Mexico, and leaving the pig asleep in the bus stop. The scariest moment on the whole walk, though, was in Venezuela, in northern South America. I walked 40 kilometres to a town that didn't exist, and then from there walked another 15 kilometres while the sun set to the next town on my map. It was nothing more than a power station. I was out of food and water, decided to keep on walking, and walked 66 kilometres until midnight, and I was walking with my torch off, and at that point, right on midnight, realised there was something in the grass in front of me. The grass on the side of the road was about a metre tall in the dry season, heard something just very, very close and flicked the torch on, half kind of knowing what it was that I was about to see. And there was a puma about 2 metres in front of me. Puma, if you don't know what it is, it's a big cat that doesn't purr much. And it's, you know, it's probably, the head of it's probably, you know, 1.20 metres above the ground. And it's a big cat. And I'd never been more scared in my life. And I still remember the hair on the back of my neck actually standing up on end. And me actually thinking, wow, it does stand up on end when you're really scared. But I had my one walking pole ready to poke and one ready to whack in case it jumped. I had the torch on in its eyes. The safety whistle on the top strap that the Russians later broke off in the fight, I had that in my mouth and blowing that as loudly as I could just to try and, I don't know, I deafen myself, just trying to deter it in some way. It just kept coming through the grass very, very slowly, just one paw at a time. It was down very low and you could just see the grass kind of flick out around it very, very slowly. It took a good minute for me to realise that it was a good idea to walk backwards. It just didn't go through my mind that that was probably the smart thing to do. So once that went through my mind, started very with jelly legs going backwards, and it laid down at that point and let me continue back up the road. It let out a very decent roar about 2 or 3 minutes later, which was enough incentive to go another couple of kilometres up the road. But I was out of it. I was severely dehydrated. And in a lot of pain and a little bit scared. So I just sat down in the grass on the side of the road and went to sleep at about 4 a.m, I think it was, and finally fell asleep. So that was the scariest moment. But the biggest impact on me over the course of the walk were the people. Every single day, there were people who played a significant role in the walk in providing accommodation, food, just their generosity with their time, their support or their encouragement in receiving the invitation to pray for unity, in helping me learn the language, etc., etc. There was a guy in South America. I was walking down the road. This is before the puma, so I hadn't learnt the lesson about walking with the torch off at this point, and so I was walking down the road with the torch off and literally ran into a guy. So country road, imagine you're, I don't know, halfway between here and Port Pirie out in the middle of nowhere, and it's pitch black. There's cloud cover, so there's no moon, and you literally run into another man walking down the road in the countryside. So we were both scared out of our minds for about 30 seconds and then calmed down and realised we weren't going to hurt each other. And from behind, I had my torch on that by this stage, and all of a sudden two little heads popped out from behind him, his two little boys, Fernando and Junior. And this guy, once he found out what I was doing, invited me to come and stay at his little house in the jungle. So we walked, it was only about 50 metres back down the road. I hadn't even seen it because there's no electricity in that part of the world and he had no running water. His house was a chicken coop. It was dirt floor, two little rooms, chicken wire for windows, flat tin roof. He let me stay there, put my hammock up for the night. And the next morning, the boys were running around with their one toy, which was a little plastic ball. And they were also riding the dog like a horse. They had a guard dog, huge dog. So they're riding that around. They're pretty happy kids. But they kept nagging their dad for something. And Venezuela was the first country, Spanish-speaking country I'd passed through. And I didn't know enough of the language and didn't know the word they were using, what they were asking for. And eventually their dad relented and said, okay, I'll get it for you. And they started to celebrate. And he walked into the other little room and came back and slammed down on the table, roll-on deodorant. I think, what on earth do they want that for? And he pulled out his big knife, popped it down on the deodorant and went bang and popped out a second identical plastic ball. And the boys picked up that ball and high-fived and drew a big circle in the ground and started to play marbles against one another. So the hospitality and the generosity was extraordinary at a very basic level. They didn't have much, but their lives actually seemed a lot happier than most. But all the way through the walk, every single day, there were people that I met who played a really significant role in that journey. What I want to do is just to quickly highlight for me what were the two, I guess, most pivotal moments on the journey itself. As I said, I haven't really mentioned the mission part of it, which was walking and praying and inviting people to pray for unity. When I left Australia, I was walking and praying for the unity of Christians theologically, as in the unity of Christians in truth, that we agree with one another, that there aren't this splattering of teachings, that we can actually say this is the truth and we're one church, we agree. But what happened was I was being confronted more and more and more with the poverty that I was seeing in South America, and it wasn't sitting well with me, and I was feeling very hypocritical walking into these towns, you know, and I stood out. 6'5", white guy with a red backpack amongst people this tall. I've got actually got a photo with a Franciscan nun who's only just above my hip. You know, I stood out and I had money in the bank and my life was, although, you know, I was roughing it a bit, you know, my life was a lot better than these people, a lot of these people I met. And it kind of came to a head in Panama, in Central America. Late in the afternoon, just before sunset, arrived in a town called El Higo. It's sort of in the Panamanian highlands on the edge of the jungle. And the locals wouldn't talk to me. They didn't know who I was or what I was about. They just didn't want anything to do with me, as far as they were concerned. Oh, by the way, the guy that held me at gunpoint did so because he thought I was an American. Once he found out I was an Australian, he told me to nick off. He wasn't going to kill me. And so when I arrived in Panama, in this little town, they just thought I was an American, wanted nothing to do with me. There was one guy who made the attempt to introduce himself, ask who I was, what I was doing. His name was Adolfo. He was 24 years old, and he had his three-year-old daughter in hand. And Adolfo was also trying to bring me into the conversation with the other guys that were sitting around in the village at the time. But they wanted nothing to do with me, and they were actually palming him off a bit as well. At the end of the night, when everyone went back to their houses and I was going to have to put my hammock up on the edge of the jungle, he came up to me with his daughter and said, "Do you need somewhere to sleep, Sam?" I said, "Yes, please." He said, "Well, you can sleep at my house if you want." So I followed him out of the village. He didn't actually live in the village. And so we walked through the darkness, down through some trees, through some banana palms, across a creek, and up onto a cleared field to his house. His house was the size of three of these tables put together. And it didn't even have a door on it. There was this massive space at the front where you walk into this one room. And it was just wooden. There were gaps between it, tin roof. Again, no running water, dirt floor, no electricity, no address, no toilet. He lived there with his wife and daughter. And he asked me if I needed something to eat for dinner. And I knew he wouldn't have much, but I was really hungry. I thought he might have a bag of rice or something. So, you know, I accepted his offer. And he said, "Just hang on a second." And he ran back up to the village and went door knocking and came back 10 minutes later with half a bread roll and a slice of sausage on it and gave it to me for dinner. The next morning, his wife and daughter walked hand in hand up into the village, leaving Adolfo and I to have breakfast together. He'd gone up in the village and managed to get a bread roll each for us. He had some lemongrass growing off to the side of his hut, and so we cut that and boiled up lemongrass tea over the fire and had that together. And we started talking about our lives. So I was talking about Australia for a while, and then we were talking about his life in Panama. And as he spoke about Panama and his life there, his sentences became slower and slower and slower, and the gap between the sentences got longer and longer until I finally realised that his eyes were beginning to well up, and he began to cry. And he said, "Sam, tomorrow morning I'm leaving my wife and daughter." He said, "I can't fend for them. I can't put food on the table." He said, "We go hungry a lot of the time. So my wife and I have put all our money together and bought a bus ticket for me. And then tomorrow morning I'm going on the bus to Panama City, which is 200 kilometres away, where he was going to live on the streets. He was going to find work. And once he'd made money, he's going to send it home to his wife and daughter." And he said, "Sam, I don't have any friends here." He said, "You know how the people wouldn't talk to you last night?" He said, they don't talk to me either." He said, "It's not just because they thought you were an American. It's because you're not one of them." He said, "And I'm not one of them." He said, "I'm from a neighbouring village, but I moved here when I married my wife. We decided to move to this village, but," he said, "they've never accepted me." He said, "My wife and my daughter are the only friends that I have." He said, "And I don't want to leave them." And he went inside. And his daughter may have had a little toy with her when she walked up to the village, but I didn't see. But he walked inside and came back out with a little plush toy. And it was Dino from the Flintstones. And he grabbed Dino and brought it out. And Dino has a key ring on the top of his head because he's a McValue Meal Dino. It's from McDonald's. It says on the tag. And he had around his thumb a thumb rosary. This is like rosary beads, but 10 beads around the thumb. And I saw a lot of guys in South America, Central America, working with their right hand and holding onto the cross with their left hand. And he slipped that off and pushed it down over Dino's head. I don't know if you can see it, just so he was wearing it like a necklace. And then he attached it to the side of my backpack. And look, by Australian standards, I was below the poverty line because I'd put all my money into this. By the time I finished, I had to use my credit card just to get home to Australia. I had no money left. But by his standards, I was absolutely living the dream because I had the choice of what I wanted to do with my money. He didn't really even have that choice. Mind you, he probably did. He could have just left his wife and child and let them fend for themselves. So he at least made the sacrificial decision to do everything he could to fend for them. But I had money. I had a credit card and a debit card, and I could go to an ATM and get money out if I wanted it. And he attached Dino to the side of my pack, and he said, "Sam, when you walk on from here today, can you please not forget us?" He said, "I'll never be able to see the world like you see it." He said, "I won't even be able to get to see all of Panama." He said, "Every single day for us is a struggle just to stay alive." He said, "Please don't forget us. Please pray for us." And I walked on from that village that day with Dino flicking into view every single step that I took for the next 11,000 kilometres. And I walked on feeling disgustingly rich and more wealthy than I cared to acknowledge. Really confronted by it. And I actually stopped walking a couple of times that day and just sat on the side of the road, pretty disillusioned with what I was doing and whether there was any nobility to it or purpose, or it rocked me. It tore me apart. Cried a few times, just couldn't deal with it. And later on, though, happened to run into a German missionary priest living in Central America. Germans are very good at speaking bluntly, putting things as they are, and not being too nice about it. And this guy was no exception. I told him, I explained to him what I was doing, and I won't try and do his German accent, but he said, "Oh, I don't care for what you're doing, and I don't think God does either." When Jesus prayed for the unity of Christians, which is John 17, just before the Passion, this German priest said he wasn't praying that we all agree with one another. He said he was praying that we're united in love and that we love one another. He said, and there's a big difference between what you're doing and what Jesus prayed for. And I actually walked on not feeling gutted that I'd walked all the way from South America to Central America praying for the wrong thing. I actually, it's almost like this epiphany of, oh yeah, that's what I'm praying for. And I felt so encouraged and motivated to walk on and had this new sense of purpose. And so learnt a little bit more of the language to be able to explain to the churches that we're praying for unity in truth and in love. So continuing Christ's prayer from John 17, but that we're united in truth and in love. And as I walked, it was almost like having the eyes open a bit, began to see how ununified the church was. I went to one church where the rich sat up the front and the poor sat down the back, and they didn't mingle during the sign of peace. And at the end of the service, the rich went back to their cars and drove off to their mansions, and the poor went back to the streets and continued begging. And meeting elderly people who offered me hospitality just so that they could have someone to talk to, because no one else in the town even knew them. And beginning to see what unity was in action. But unity effectively is love in action. Loving your neighbour is being united with them. And who's your neighbour? Absolutely everyone. Actually giving us stuff about the world that we live in, giving us stuff about the people around us and ourselves, and wanting to carry Christ's love into the world. Probably the biggest lesson, other than what unity is, that I learned is that God is trustworthy. I've got a couple more minutes, so I want to finish with this. I was in Wyoming in the United States, and Wyoming, there are more deer than there are people. All right? It's the least inhabited state in the USA. And I arrived in a small town called Medicine Bow, and it was minus 18 degrees Celsius, and I was all kitted up with all my gear on. It was very cold. My water supply had frozen solid that day. It was only a short day, which was great. Arrived at the pub. There wasn't anything else in town. It was a tiny little place. And I was asking the locals for help for the next part of the journey, because from Medicine Bow to the city of Casper, it was 148 kilometres with nothing in between. Shirley Basin was in between. Shirley Basin, if you ever saw Dances with Wolves, it was filmed in the basin next door. So it's that kind of terrain. It's wide open, middle of nowhere. It's freezing cold. It's 3 days worth of walking. And I was asking the locals what was out there. Was there a service station? Was there a shop? Was there a little township? And they're saying, nothing. There is nothing out there at all. Don't do it. Some locals had died. Some tourists had died out there because of the cold. Some locals had recently died. A mother and two children broke down in their car. By the time a passerby drove by, they had frozen to death out in the basin. So the locals are saying, don't be stupid. One guy actually said to me, congratulations, you walked all the way from Brazil. Don't do it. He's basically saying you don't need to prove anything. Get the bus. There's a bus the next morning. You can drive into Casper. You'll arrive at 11 a.m. the next morning, and you can continue walking from there. I could only carry a day and a half's worth of food in my backpack, so that gets me to halfway. I've then got another day and a half without any food. My water supply would be frozen solid anyway, so I've got no water at all. So I resigned to the fact that I agreed with them. It would be irresponsible to walk across Shirley Basin, so I was going to get the bus. And I sat down to eat my counter meal, and much like, I'm sure, if you ever go to church and you're not actually praying anything, you're just quiet before God. And that's what I was doing, except I wasn't in church, I was in a pub, as here we are. And I was just quiet before God. And while I was eating my meal, just had this sense like God said one word and one word alone, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And that one word was trust. And I'd been through so much to get to that point. I thought, okay, I'm not going to dismiss this. God, I'll do it. But if I die, it's your fault. So got up really early the next morning and started walking before any of the locals could stop me, and headed out across Shirley Basin. So 3 days worth of walking ahead of me before the next civilization. And the wind was hitting me pretty hard from the Arctic. It was a little bit warmer. It wasn't quite minus 18. It was a bit warmer than that, but it was still freezing cold. But in the early morning, not long after sunrise, the wind swung around from the north to the west. It kind of coughed and splattered and then bang, hit me from the west. And it was what the local Indians call a Chinook wind. And a Chinook wind is... Chinook means snow eater. It's a dry, warm wind. It doesn't melt the snow, it evaporates it. And over the course of the day, the snowy wilderness turned to grass. It disappeared. By the end of the day, there was only tiny little dots of snow left on the ground. And I walked 50 k's that day, and by the end of the day, the wind had stopped completely. It was dead calm. And I decided in my head, okay, I'm going to walk 50 k's today, even if it hurts or I find a nice spot at 40 k's or whatever, I'm going to get to 50 k's and that's where I'll stop. Got there just before sunset, and there was a bale of hay sitting on the side of the road. And I didn't have a mattress, so I kicked the bale of hay together and put my tent down on top of that as a mattress. And had my little meal up on a little hill on the side, and a white-tailed deer behind me and a herd of antelope out in front. So a really peaceful kind of moment out there. And then went to bed at about 5:30 p.m. I think it was the sun had set, and it was winter. And slept until 2:30. Woke up freezing my butt off. And I was wearing all the thermal gear, full thermal gear with a thermal, it's not a sleeping bag, it's called an inner. So thermal inner inside my sleeping bag, inside a survival bag, inside my tent. Curled up in the fetal position, shivering and just not being able to move. And I didn't want to, you know, when you're half asleep and you don't want to go to the toilet, but you should. I didn't want to get up, and because I still wanted to sleep. I was tired and lasted till 4 a.m. shivering, and then thought, I've got to get up. And actually prayed the prayer. My morning prayer before I got up was, God, this sucks. I'm getting up. And that was my prayer. So got up. Very difficult to undo a muesli bar. Even more difficult to pack your tent up with all the gear on. And started walking, water supply frozen solid again. I don't know what the temperature got to that night, but when I flicked my torch on in the tent, there were icicles above my head from my breath. And I breathed onto the tent, just went, and it went and froze, and you could then scratch your breath off. So I am convinced it was below minus 33. It was freezing cold. Walked on into the morning, and I walked for 5 hours without water and was getting parched. And a white pickup came rumbling down the road, and he pulled up alongside me, wound his window down, and this thick Wyoming accent goes, "What in the hell are you doing out here?" And I thought about saying to this guy, "I'm just walking to Casper," and leaving it at that. And I thought, no, I'll tell this guy exactly why I'm here. I've got his attention in the middle of nowhere. So told him why I was there and why I was doing what I was doing. And this fella just kind of looked me up and down for a minute, and I'm half expecting him to wind the window up and drive on down the road. But he cracked a smile, and he's gone, "Hallelujah, Jesus!" And this guy was the most full-on evangelical I think I've ever met in my life. Every sentence finished with "Praise you, Jesus," or "Hallelujah," or "Amen." And he asked me if I needed something to drink, which I did. And he said, he ferreted around and found this huge bottle of Gatorade that he hadn't even opened. And he handed me that and found some Snickers bars and gave me that. He was excited about the invitation to pray for unity and said he'd take that onto his church that following weekend. And we parted company and I walked on down the road rehydrating and on a sugar high from the Snickers bars. And late in the afternoon, for whatever reason, I had a craving for peanut butter. I wanted a piece of bread with peanut butter on it. And the white pickup came rumbling down the road in the other direction. He's heading home. He'd been into Casper and bought himself a vacuum cleaner and was heading back to his town. And he pulled up alongside me and jumped out and threw some Reese Buttercups to me. He said, "I didn't know what you like to eat, so I got your Reese Buttercups." Reese Buttercups are chocolate cupcakes filled with peanut butter. They will kill you, but they're great. So again, walked on into the sunset in Wyoming on another sugar high, eating my Reese Buttercups, and arrived. The locals had told me back in Medicine Bow that if I got in trouble, there was a ranch at the 61-mile mark, so 101 kilometres into the walk. And I arrived just after sunset at the front gate to the ranch and walked up along the driveway to ask for permission to put my tent down at the front gate. And when I got up there, you know, on most farms, they have a farmhouse, some sheds, and maybe a windmill. This guy had a farmhouse, some sheds, and a stadium just sitting there on his little ranch. And there was a Wednesday. On that weekend, the following weekend, they were hosting the Wyoming State Rodeo Championships indoor on their ranch. And so there were trucks everywhere. There were guys welding. So it's nighttime by now, and so you can see all these flashes of guys welding fences and gates together. And there was a truckload of cattle being unloaded, and there was a couple of horses being led past me. And I walked up to a guy and just asked him where the owner was, and he pointed to the stadium and said, "Oh, he's in there." He said, "Just push through the door." He said, "There's three guys in there having a meeting. He's one of them. Nice guy. Just go in." So I walked over to the stadium and opened the door up, and there were three guys all standing up against the fence like this, two on one side, one on the other, all completely fitted out like they're on Sesame Street as cowboys. They've all got the chaps on the front on their shins, spurs on the back of their boots, big cowboy hats. One guy has straw hanging out his mouth. They've all got, all three of them have little vests on with their shirts they got from Country Road. And they're standing there having their official meeting about the state rodeo championships. And as I walked through the door, they stopped their meeting and kind of turned to look at me. And someone outside welding blew a fuse. And it went bang, dark. And I mean, can't see your hand in front of your face, dark. So I've just walked in the door, they've stopped and looked at me and boom, gone. So I had on my head a little walker's light that was off at that point. So I just reached up and flicked it on and it lit up our area. And the head cowboy's name was Jet, J-E-T, Jet the cowboy. And Jet kind of swaggered off the fence with a little grin on his face and he said, "Well, I got no idea who you are, but I'm sure glad you came." And Jet turned out to be a Christian as well, and he said he'd be praying for unity and he'd take the invitation to his church as well. And he said, "Oh, please don't put your tent down the front." He said, "Put it up here anywhere you like around the stadium." Showed me where some fresh water was and topped up my supply and put my tent down. Got into my tent and then thought, "Oh, Sam, you're an idiot." I was out of food. It was the end of the second day. I was on a sugar high still from the Reese Buttercups, but I had no food left. I hadn't had dinner. I was thinking, if I'd only asked Jet. Like, he was such a nice guy, I'm sure he would have got me some food. While I'm sitting there thinking that, I can hear footsteps coming towards the tent. So I unzipped it just to make sure it's not a rogue cow coming towards me. And there was Jet fumbling his way towards me with his arms laden up with food. He'd gone home and told his wife what I was doing, and she had just piled him up. And so there was homemade spiced jerky, there was some rolls, there was hot cake, and there was scones that were still steaming, just come out of the oven. There was water, there was fruit juice. There was enough food for me to have dinner, to have breakfast the next morning, lunch the next day, and to run out of food about afternoon tea time, only an hour before I arrived in Casper, which was fine. So I walked for the last hour without eating, which is kind of normal anyway. So arrived in Casper at about 4 p.m. the next day, and I was I was in a lot of pain. I actually had a really bad chest infection from the first night, from 2 hours of shivering at minus 30, minus 40, whatever it was. A really bad chest infection, was wheezing, feeling very lethargic, had no energy. My left toe was bleeding so badly that every step that I took, you could hear it squelch in blood. And so when I walked into Casper, the first thing I remember seeing was the Super 8 Motel, and I was in love with this hotel. I was already dreaming of my hot shower and a king-size bed and a meal that I was going to eat in bed. And I was not in that place of prayer that I was talking about before when I was in the pub in Medicine Bow. I was in love with a bed and a shower. And it was as though God overrode those thoughts. And I just felt God say, almost like hitting me with a plank of 4B2, saying, "Sam, you did not come here to go to hotels. You came here to go to the churches. Do the mission." And I swear, if God was standing beside me, I may well have pushed him in front of an oncoming bus. I did not want... I was in so much pain, and I was hungry, even though it had only been an hour since I'd eaten. But I was hungry, I was sore, I was tired. I hadn't had a shower in those 3 days. And I kind of grappled with it for a few minutes as I approached the Super 8 Motel, and then thought, okay, I'll do it. I'll go to the churches. And then realised there was a Pentecostal church just before the Super 8 Motel, just tucked in behind it. So went down in there. There's just a cleaner there, but she said she'd take the invitation on to the pastor. Walked out very begrudgingly past the Super 8 Motel and all these other hotels on the outskirts of Casper, and walked past locked church after locked church, no one there. And then eventually was walking through suburbia and walked on for an hour through Casper, and then just prayed a very small prayer again, which was, "God, I need to stop. It's hurting too much. I need to stop walking, but I'll do one more church. So you give me one more church, I'll stop walking." And that's it. The next church I came to, only about 5 minutes later, was the Catholic Church. And I walked up to the presbytery and knocked on the door, and a mini version of Hagrid opened up. This big bloke with a beard. And I told him what I was doing and extended the invitation to him to invite his congregation to pray for unity. And he just kind of, he took a bit of a breath and looked at me, and then turned around and looked inside his house, and then turned back to me and he said, "My dinner's in there on the table getting cold, and my team is about to play off in the World Series baseball final. This is the most inappropriate time possible." But God only puts people in my life at inappropriate times. He said, "Can I find you somewhere to sleep?" I said, "That'll be great, thanks." So he put me in the car and drove me to the Marriott. It's a 5-star hotel, and put me upstairs for 2 nights on his credit card. And he said, "Sam, can you meet me downstairs at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning?" I said, "For 2 nights in the Marriott? Done." So next morning, Father Fox was his name. Father Fox met me downstairs, and he drove me to Mass. And he got me to, at the end of Mass, invited me forward to extend the invitation to the full church to pray for unity and to explain a bit about the journey. And at the end of Mass, we walked out together, and he leant across to me as we're walking out, and he said, "Sam, I have a confession to make." And I'm thinking, well, this is a bit of an inappropriate time. And he had a bit of a grin on his face, though, and he said, "I've made a few phone calls." He said, "It'll make sense in a minute." We walked out of the church into a press conference. The state television crews, there were 3 television crews, 2 newspapers and a radio station waiting to conduct an interview. And we got set up, and they asked the first question. I answered that. The second question was, "Why is unity important?" And I drew breath to answer it, and Father Fox chimed in and answered it so much more beautifully and succinctly than I could have ever done at that point. And I thought to myself, whoa, where'd that come from? And one of the newspaper reporters leant forward and said, "Sorry, who are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm Father Fox. I'm Wyoming's delegate for the unity of Christians." I'm standing there going, "You sod." He hadn't let up the whole time. The point is, by the time we'd finished the interview, etc., the next day it was on every news station. It was on the front page of the newspapers. The radio station was giving updates from that point on. 2 days later, I walked into a town called Shoshone, and there was a guy at the petrol station on the edge of town filling up his car. And as I walked in, he looks over and goes, "Hey, Ozzy, we're praying." And that was it. He continues filling up his car. The thing is, the invitation to pray for unity went so much further than I could have carried it. It went all across Wyoming. From then on, I didn't have to introduce myself in towns. They knew who I was. They knew what I was doing. Had mothers come and find me on the road with little comfort packs to keep me going. One woman came to me and said, "I bought you a comfort pack." And I thought, I've imagined like a comfort pack with lavender soap and a washcloth, but it was food, so I was quite happy. Actually, lavender soap wouldn't have been too bad, actually. But the invitation went so much further than I could have carried it. It went into neighbouring states, into Montana. It made it into Canada. From the interviews that stemmed from the Canadian reporters wanting to come and find me, it made it to the Vatican. From the Vatican, it made it into Poland, into Malta. I didn't even walk through Malta. And there's heaps of people. I had a blog, and each week I'd write on the blog and upload some photographs, and there was a prayer list. And all of a sudden, all these Maltese are appearing on the prayer list. All these Maltese. Here we got one here. A few to hear. And so it went so much further than I could have carried it. And I look back and realise that I nearly missed it. I very nearly missed the opportunity for the invitation to be carried so far around the world because I very nearly took the bus and I very nearly took the Super 8 motel. And I realise now back in Australia that, metaphorically speaking, I take the bus day in, day out. I don't trust God. You know what? It would have been cool to take the bus across Shirley Basin. I'd love to go back and do it. I have no intention of walking across it again. I'd love to go back and do that. But compared to walking it, it would have been boring and fruitless, frivolous. It hurt, and it does hurt. I learnt that it hurts to trust God. He doesn't make it easy. But the fruit born from trusting and going through that pain is so much more beautiful and satisfying and fulfilling than taking the bus and taking the easy road in not taking up the cross. And I've also learnt that probably the hardest place to trust God is not Shirley Basin. It's one-on-one relationships, particularly with a person you love. Love. That is the hardest place. I'm actually engaged. I'm getting married in October. And I don't think there is a more difficult place to trust than to bring God into those relationships and to say, "God, you're in charge. God, I trust you. God, I'm going to stand up for what I believe and not just cross boundaries left, right and centre." That is the hardest place. But the invitation went off across the world and it continues now. The walking has finished. The walking side of the mission has finished, but it's now given me a platform to work full-time. I work full-time as a public speaker. I'm here in Adelaide for 2 weeks in high schools, talking with the high school students. And the invitation is exactly the same, and that is to pray for unity. And to pray for unity every day at 4:01. So set the alarm on your watch or on your phone for 4:01, and when the alarm goes off at 4:01, to pray for one. Do you get it? Pray for one at 4:01. And the thing is also to not do the McDonald's prayer. I really encourage the students and you guys as well to not do the McDonald's prayer of, "Dear God, can we please have world peace and can I have a side order of unity? Thanks." But to include ourselves in it, particularly what we're passionate about. Unity is kind of an all-encompassing thing. Unity is love in action. And there are so many ways in which we can love and be united with people who really desperately need us to be united with them, whether it be the homeless, the refugees, could be right to life of the unborn. It could be of, somewhere like Guatemala City, where there are 21 murders a day. Walked into a village where a young girl had just been cut open and her organs removed. And the locals suspected three women that did it, so went to the house, pulled them out, lynched them, burnt them alive. And I arrived the next day after that had happened. Town's as happy as can be, playing the trumpet, guy in the town square playing the trumpet, everyone's smiling. It's just no respect for life. There's no value on it. It could be that what you're really passionate about is racism. It could be those who do not know that they are loved by God. And there are so many ways that we can be united with those around us. And so the invitation is to pray for unity every day, because ultimately it's the biggest factor in us being united is God's grace. But to include ourselves in that invitation and to ask God, to include ourselves in that prayer and to ask God to use us to make a difference somewhere in our world or in our community. Guys, thank you very much for coming out tonight, and God bless. Thank you.
We'll just take a few questions now, so if you want a few minutes to think of a few questions. Sam, thanks for that. That was fantastic. Another quick round of applause for Sam. That's very fantastic. Yeah. All right. It's question time. So if anyone's got a question, put their hand up and we'll field it.
When I got back, I thought that I had learnt to trust God completely, trust Him with my life. And I learnt very quickly when I started going out with Catherine and then we got engaged that I didn't. And as it seems so much less big, as in on the world scale, but it's as though the next step from walking around the world was learning to love someone and learning to trust God. We're in a long-distance relationship. She lives in the USA. I didn't meet her on the walk. We actually knew each other before then. But just personally, that's been the next step. The next step has been to learn how to love someone intimately. So that's not... I don't know if that's a big message for anyone else, but for me, that has been the very real thing. And I have to actually look back to the walk to gain strength for the relationship at times. Yeah. Yeah, overcoming fear, also knowing that she is very different. You know, we have a lot of things in common, but she's a different person. And it's confronting to let go of a certain amount of independence. I don't have a fixed address at the moment. I don't have an address. I move around the country doing speaking engagements full time. And we're not going to do that when we're married. So, you know, just in little things, I think that's been the big thing. Yeah, but the unity side of it still carries on. Even today, I had to get back to basics and realise that it's what I need to do is pray. Because I was getting weighed down. I was actually thinking about how to, you know, because I've got different projects going on, right? I do the seminars in high schools, but I do other things as well. And I was getting a bit weighed down by how do you make an impact? And then had to get back to basics and think, it's actually God. It's I need to pray. I need to continue to pray and get back to it. We're trying to find Adolfo. He's not in the town anymore. I managed to get a guy to go back to the town. He's not in that town. His wife's not there, so they've moved. But the photo's been distributed and they're trying to find him. So we've got a few guys who have actually raised some money to try and help him, if we can just find him. But yeah, nothing huge. I think it's basic stuff. Yeah, trust. Mother Rob. Absolutely. Yes. At the same time, I have to say that I received genuine hospitality in every single church and I received the cold shoulder in every single church, including I had letters of recommendation from archbishops. I had one from the Vatican. And I still had Catholic priests slam the door in my face without even saying all the best, or not saying a single word, just slam the door in the face and walk on. But yeah, some of the evangelical Christians, I didn't... After I was pinned to the ground in Guatemala by a Pentecostal preacher and he prayed a prayer of... I don't know whether he was praying a prayer of exorcism or what he was doing, but he pinned me to the ground and prayed over me and I couldn't get up. He was a huge guy. After that, I didn't introduce myself as Catholic. I introduced myself as a missionary and then at the end of the conversation, it came up. And so a lot of people were very surprised that I was a Catholic and I appeared to have a relationship with God and I prayed. There are a lot of questions stem from that. The main one was, why do you worship Mary? But every single time that I just gave a very basic answer, the exact same line kept coming out of their mouth. Oh, that kind of makes sense. It's just that they'd actually been taught or told something that wasn't necessarily true. And I also met a lot of Catholics who didn't quite know their stuff. And so if they're learning from then no wonder. So... yeah, they were. They were kind of surprised. It was great. A lot of, yeah, made some good friends in a lot of other denominations. Yeah, very much so. It's not, that didn't ever fall. It's just that realised that it's like looking at a foothill and then realising there's a massive mountain behind it, which is love. Yeah. I don't think truth and love can actually exist separated from each other. They kind of draw each other in. Sorry, I'll go down the back, guy in the back. 3.5, but I was wearing $500 boots, so they're made for that. I'm a size 16 though, so I had to have them shipped in. but only 3.5 pairs, still wearing one of them. Yeah, I'd say unity of Christians. So rather than specifying unity of churches, unity of Christians, which inevitably is unity of churches. And it was one of Christ's final prayers that all... So John 17:23, that's your homework tonight. John 17:23. So Jesus prayed for the complete unity of all people of faith so that the world would see that God has loved us as he's loved the Son. So effectively, the way that we love one another is our greatest evangelical tool. So, yes, I think it is still extremely important for the churches to be united. But I'd put it on the terms of... Yeah, I always talk about Christians being fully united. Does that answer the question? No, I'm not saying that truth doesn't matter. And we've got some significant... All right, if you want to take something like the Eucharist, either it is the body of Christ or it is bread. It's not... Yeah, and you go all the way across the spectrum. I'm not saying that we just disregard that. We've got some hard yards to do. But as I was saying, at the beginning when I was inviting people just to even pray for unity, they wouldn't do it. So they're not... A lot of churches produce a lot of material against other churches, but then refuse to sit down at the table and actually talk to one another. So it's not just about getting along with one another and slapping each other on the back. There's some really genuinely hard work to be done to be united fully. Yeah. Look, there was the time with just after meeting Adolfo when I thought that maybe what I was doing was pointless. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to finish, but I was just grappling with this, what's the point kind of idea. There was one point in France. I was only a month and a half from finishing, and I wanted to go home. I missed having a fridge. I missed having a bed. It wasn't so much that I wanted to get on a plane and go home then. It's just that I wanted to get to the end now. I was getting impatient. I just wanted to finish up. No, when I got held at gunpoint and the puma, and I got struck at by snakes all the time, and I hate snakes. I walked, actually walking down the road in Venezuela, suddenly realised that I'm walking past an anaconda strewn out, and so nearly had a heart attack and like scattered across the other side of the road, and then realised it was a roadkill, it was dead. So I hate snakes. And so there were plenty of times where I wanted to be somewhere else, but not home. I just wanted to get out of that situation. I wanted to finish and keep going. Yeah, well, I think praying is the foundation. It's not. We then have to actually put into action. We've got to step out. So I work full time on these seminars. I'm also a consultant for the Archdiocese of Tasmania, and we're building a 610-kilometre pilgrimage route across Tasmania. It's a $30 million project, though, so it's taking a lot of time because it's across 14 councils. The church isn't paying for it, so we've got to convince the council, state government and federal government to pay for it. Now, we're working in conjunction. It's the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, a Hutterite Christian community, and a few other Protestant churches are working together on this in establishing a pilgrimage route. And then the churches themselves will supply the hospitality and provide the spiritual input for people. So you can walk. It'll take about 24 days to walk across Tasmania through wilderness and through farming land and the townships. And so the churches... That's the only thing that comes to mind straight off the top of my head. But working together in that, in actually establishing this route and the pilgrimage and the accommodation, etc. And as you were saying, when you go down to Encounter down at... Victor Harbour, down at Victor Harbour. It's the similar thing is once you actually start talking to one another, you actually find you have more in common than you thought. And that sets a fantastic foundation as well. We need more projects. More things where we can actually just come together and to find out what we do have in common. I think it is also important to establish what we don't have in common. And that inevitably comes out as well. I'm not working on too much else at the moment. I'm kind of craving sleep at the moment. Yeah. Yeah, I met a Pentecostal minister, a woman in the United States. And she told me that she opened her home up and I stayed there with her and her husband. And she told me that she'd grown up Catholic and her first husband had become an alcoholic, turned abusive and was beating her. and she didn't know who to turn to, and she was ashamed, and so the person she turned to was the priest. And she spilled the guts to him and crying, and he patted her on the back and said, "Just pray three Hail Marys, you'll be okay," and walked off, leaving her. And she said she's never stepped foot in a Catholic church again. And it was a Pentecostal church who helped her and took her in and you know, helped to get out of that relationship. And she's now married to a guy. She's now the minister in that church. And she asked me, she just eyeballed me and said, "How can you be part of a church that has that as their teaching?" I had to say, "Well, sorry, it's not the teaching of the Catholic Church to pat you on the back and say, just pray three Hail Marys, you'll be okay." And to tell her that she just had a... She had a priest who, unfortunately, just wasn't... He didn't give a stuff about her and apologise. And we had a really good church and a really good chat. And she was really... She was actually really relieved to hear that it was not the teaching of the Catholic Church, that that's how you get out of an abusive relationship. And there were a lot of things like that. It was difficult, though, going through South America particularly. There's Catholic and there's Pentecostal, and they really don't like each other. And there's a lot of angst towards each other. A lot of that was happening, just basic explaining. And it happened the other way. There were actually times in the Catholic Church when I had to actually defend the other Christian denominations and say, "Hang on a second, that's not true. Okay, I know a lot of evangelicals and that is not what they believe." I'll just say outright, it's not part of my mission, what I'm praying for. I'm praying specifically for the unity of Christians. I did, though, have some interaction in a town in France. The Catholic priest palmed me off and walking down the road looking for I didn't actually ask for accommodation. I discovered that if I asked for accommodation, the invitation to pray for unity was lost. They felt like I was using that as a means to try and get accommodation. So I extend the invitation, and then if I just ask, I say, "Do you know if there's somewhere around here where I could stay?" If they offer their house, fantastic. If they say, "Oh, there's a hotel down the road," or "There's a hostel," just thank them, say, "All the best, thanks very much," and walk on. And more often than not, was when I walked on that I then got a call back. They go, "Oh, hang on, like, okay, he's actually walking away. He's not after anything. I didn't ask for food or money or anything." And they call me back and give me accommodation. And in this town, the priest is just one of those guys. Might have just had a bad day. He just had nothing to do with me and palmed me off and walked on down the road and had nowhere. There's nowhere I could stay. And this young Muslim kid came up and asked me what I was doing, and I told him. I said, "Oh," he said, come with me." And so we went back to the bar, the local Muslim bar, where all the guys are sitting up having a drink. And this young kid introduced me, and all these guys pulled up a seat for me and sat around and asked me to talk about what I was doing. And we had this huge conversation about unity, and they got me accommodation for the night and looked after me and sent me on the way the next day. So that was the only real... I didn't meet anyone who was Jewish on the entire trip. Maybe I did, but they didn't say so. But no, I'm specifically praying for the unity of Christians, and then I think beyond that, you know... I think it's a matter of taking the plank out of our own eye first and then move on. I wasn't settled down before I walked. I grew up on Flinders Island out in Bass Strait. I used to run around in bare feet hunting wild turkeys with a bow and arrow. My childhood, we didn't have key hooks in our house because you never took the keys out of the car. Like it was safe, there was no crime. So I grew up on the move, and thankfully my fiancée has as well. She's from a huge wheat farm in central Kansas and doesn't like sitting still. Seriously, she's like a five-year-old if she's on a two-hour trip in a car. She can't sit still. So we won't be... No, I don't think I will settle down. I think I'll continue to be, hopefully, a nomad for God. Yeah. Last one. No, I wouldn't go too much with... I mean, yes, definitely as a starter, the respect, but I think if we start to say, well, we start to become the Church of Pontius Pilate, of what is truth. You can believe what you believe and I'll believe what I want to believe, and that's fine. And so we need to actually say either it is truth or it's not. It is more along the lines of... There is only one church. We've got to be real about this. We can call it everything we want, but there is only one church. But we're not united. So we can stick labels on it. And we've also got to remember there is incredible diversity in unity. Unity is not uniformity. So there's incredible diversity in unity, but truth has to be truth and love has to be love. And we've got to, I think, continue to aim for that. And if we make excuses as to not, I think we're cutting ourselves short. We'll leave it at that. Thank you. Cheers.
Just to close the night, I'll get Father Rob, if that's okay, up to give a quick blessing.
Thank you, Michael. We ask your blessing upon Sam and his lifelong pilgrimage and all of us here as we walk towards the eternal Easter. And may Almighty God bless us, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.